meeting of 2020 will also include a delegates assembly to elect WBAI representatives to the Pacifica National Board. Meetings of the local station board are open to the public, and as always, there will be an opportunity for public comment. The meeting is wheelchair accessible. Again, that's Wednesday, January 8th at 7 p.m. at the YWCA on 33rd Avenue, Brooklyn, New York. Listeners and the public are invited and welcome. You don't have to contribute to WBAI to come to the meeting, but why not? See you Wednesday.
WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. It's 10 o'clock. Coming up next, Talk Out of School with Carol Burris.
Up in the morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule. American history and practical math. You study them hard and hoping to pass. Working your fingers right down to the bone. And the guy behind you won't leave you alone. Ring, ring goes the bell. Cooking the lunchroom ready to sell. You're lucky if you can find a seat. You're fortunate if you have time to eat. Back in the classroom, open your books. Gee, but the teacher don't know how mean she looks. Soon as 3 o'clock rolls around.
Good morning and happy new year. My name is Carol Burris. I'm a retired high school principal and the executive director of the Network for Public Education. And this is Talk Out of School, a show where we focus on issues affecting public schools here in New York City, in New York State, and also nationally. And before we begin with today's guest, what I'd like to remind all of our listeners is that our national conference is coming up in March. That's March 28th and 29th, and it's in Philadelphia. So there is no excuse not to be there. It's close. And you can register for that conference at www.npeaction.org. Now, the new legislative session is beginning in Albany, and that always tends to make me very nervous. I can remember years where all kinds of devilment happened, like evaluating teachers by test scores and the Common Core, and a lot of teacher bashing. And a lot of that is already gone, but there's still one thorny issue that affects public schools, and that is the cap on the number of charter schools that are allowed. And we're pretty sure that that's going to be coming up again in this legislative agenda. So let's talk for just a minute about that cap in case some of the listeners are not familiar with it. Current New York State law permits 466 charter schools to be open statewide. Now, we haven't reached the cap yet. There are still 100 slots remaining. However, in New York City, there's a subcap. And that cap has been reached. Now, all of the charter schools, whether they're in the state or in New York City, they can still grow. They can still add more kids. They can still expand that way. But new schools cannot be started in the city right now unless that cap is lifted. Supporters of lifting the cap will say that there is a huge demand for charter schools and that there are extensive waiting lists, though we never really get to see those waiting lists, and therefore we need new charter schools and not just the present charter schools taking in more kids. But there are a lot of people who are opposed to that. I want to share with you a quote from the United Federation of Teachers President Mike Mulgrew that I think sums up a lot of the opposition to lifting the cap in New York City. And what Michael Mulgrew said is we are already losing almost $2.1 billion a year in city funding, money that would make a huge difference for our students and our school system. And that loss of money, of course, is because of charter schools. He also continued to say charter schools are not accountable for how they spend public funds and continue to push out students with the greatest needs. We cannot allow our schools to be decimated by a charter system that fails to serve all children and refuses to be transparent about their operation. Which brings us to today's show and the debate about which side is right. So in order to give some background about that, I have two guests who come from a state right next door. That state is the state of Pennsylvania. And Pennsylvania is a state that has not had a cap on charter schools, and where charter schools, including cyber charter schools, have really kind of grown wild. And they're going to talk with us a little bit about some of the implications of that for Pennsylvania as we even debate the idea of having a cap in New York State. My first guest is Peter Green. Peter Green taught English to grades 7 through 12 for over a 39-year career. He's just recently retired, but he is certainly not out of the fight. His education policy blog, Curmudgeocation, is now entering its 8th year, and he also writes about education as a progressive fellow and senior contributor for Forbes.com. Peter lives in rural northwest Pennsylvania with his still-in-the-classroom wife and their twin toddlers. And our second guest after the break will be Susan Spicker. Susan is the executive director of Education Voters of PA. Prior to moving to Shippensburg, Pennsylvania in 2002, Susan taught English in a high school with a high number of economically disadvantaged students in Columbus, Ohio, where she saw firsthand both the incredible power of public education to change the lives of students and also the challenges that our public schools face. Susan and her husband have two daughters. Both of those daughters attend public schools. And she has been involved in grassroots advocacy for public education since 2011. And remember, we also want you to enter the dialogue, so be sure to call in at the break. That number is 212-209-2877. Again, 212-209-2877. That will give you an opportunity to ask questions of both of our guests and me. So, now, Peter, are you there?
I'm here.
Thank you so much, Peter, for being on the show today. So you were not only a teacher. During that time, you were quite an advocate and continue to be an advocate for public education. And one of the ways that you did that and still continue to do that is by having a blog, which those of us who read it absolutely love. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that blog and why you got it started.
Oh, thank you. And thanks for having me this morning. Probably a decade ago, like lots of teachers, I started trying to look behind the curtain and figure out what the heck was going on and where Common Core was coming from and how we were going to deal with the problems of No Child Left Behind that were becoming more pronounced for those of us in the classroom. And just the more I looked and the more I read, the more cranky I got. And I needed an outlet. I was starting to drive my colleagues crazy inside the building. So I started blogging, and it took a little while for me to kind of find my voice and my direction, but mostly the blog started out as an exercise in venting for me. And like many people who have gotten into that area, what I quickly discovered that there were an awful lot of teachers around the country and parents around the country whose reaction was, me too. I thought I was crazy, but now I realize I'm not the only person seeing this stuff. And it just sort of grew from there.
So what have been some of your favorite blogs over the years? What have you most enjoyed blogging about and have gotten the best reaction for?
I've gotten big reactions about things that are just aspects of teachers' life. Probably one of the most read pieces I ever wrote was just about the fact that as a teacher, you have to deal with the feeling of never quite having enough. There's never quite enough time, never quite enough resources and time and energy to do everything that you know you need to do. And a lot of teaching is figuring out ways to to make your peace with that and get a little closer to what you want to be doing every year. And an awful lot of people responded to that.
Can you share with our listeners where they can find your blog?
It's at curmudgeducation.blogspot.com. If you search for curmudgeucation, it's my own made up word, so you won't find it. At any place you find it, it'll lead you back to me.
Thank you, Peter. And what about Forbes? What are you doing now with Forbes online?
Forbes, I write for Forbes about twice a week, and that writing is for a more general audience, people who aren't constantly eating, sleeping, and breathing education policy. So it's aimed a little more at making some of the big issues in education and education policy a little more understandable to the average civilian. And that's been, it's been a nice opportunity to reach a slightly different audience and to kind of force myself to back up. When you spend so much time thinking about this stuff, it's sometimes easy to forget that not everybody spends so much time thinking about it and to force yourself to back up and explain things in a way that makes sense to people who haven't been paying that close of attention.
Well, one of the big changes that you've seen, I think, over your career and that you've written about frequently has been the push for privatization. And that's been a national push led by people like Betsy DeVos. But it's also, I think, a big push in the state of Pennsylvania. Can you tell us a little bit about that push in Pennsylvania for charter schools, cyber charters, and vouchers?
Yeah, in Pennsylvania, it's been largely open season for privatization of schools. We're a heavily Republican legislature, even though we're not necessarily a heavily Republican state. We're pretty spectacularly gerrymandered in some areas, and that's allowed the GOP to maintain a majority. And there's been, in Harrisburg, in our state capital, there have always been a lot of folks who really are not fans of public education at all, and who really believe that education would be better handled as a private business, privately owned and operated, and that would be the solution because we have tremendous education funding problems in this state. That's their idea of a solution. Well, just turn it over to private businesses and let them run it, and then we won't have to worry about funding it anymore. And we are one of the big three states for cyber schools. There's no limitations on them at all, and they are everywhere. And as you said, no caps on brick and mortar charters, which has led to some school districts that have really been hit hard. There are two districts I can think of. Erie is one, and Chester Uplands is another, where the public system has been almost entirely wiped out, and local officials have, in effect, thrown up their hands at one point or another and said, look, either the state is going to help us out, or we're just going to shut down half of the school district and walk away because we can't do it anymore.
Yeah, I think one of the things that the listeners need to realize is that Pennsylvania funds charter schools the same way that New York State does, which is that the money from the district when the child leaves, a large proportion of the money and per pupil spending goes with the child. And in the case of special education students in Pennsylvania, the amount is incredibly high. It could be up to $34,000 a year. And yet, ironically, the charter schools are not even obligated to provide the services for special ed kids. And it doesn't matter what the disability is. It could be a mild disability, maybe needing speech services, or it could be something that's a little bit more serious. So charter schools rarely ever handle those. But what happens is huge amounts of money leave the school. And it's also based on what the district spends. So it's more attractive, for example, to have a charter school in a district where the district is spending more per pupil than in a district where they do not have the resources to spend quite as much. I'm wondering if can you talk a little bit about Chester Upland? I know a little bit about it, but I'd like to hear it from your perspective.
Well, they were, I remember Chester Upland because they had the dubious distinction of actually sending more money to charters than they got from the state. Not only did they lose lost all of their state funding, but lost a good chunk of their local tax funding as well to charters. And a part of it was because of, as you said, special education students can be huge cash cows for charter systems.
I think there's another important part of that story, too, is that the operator of the large charter chain in town is a for-profit company. It's called CSMI. And they're raking in the cash. They had two charter schools also in New Jersey, one of which in Camden folded because in great part what they were charging for rent was so exorbitantly high. And then there's another charter school that's in Atlantic City, and that one closed, where there was another charter school in Atlantic City. And Chester Upland, 1 year, had no money to pay its teachers. And its teachers for the first few months of school actually worked for free. And it's really, I mean, when you think about it, it's outrageous. And our recent report that I know you reviewed so well, Still Asleep at the Wheel, has a whole section on for-profit charter schools and how people make money from public funds through the for-profits and through the for-profit management companies, because they'll always have the charter school as a nonprofit as almost the front. And I really encourage listeners to go to our website, www.networkforpubliceducation.org, and download that report. Now, you were with me not too long ago, Peter, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where there was a forum. And the forum was a forum of all of the major candidates for the Democratic nomination. And each of them, in turn, had to step up to the plate and talk about what they wanted to do for public schools. And you wrote about it afterwards. I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners what you learned.
I think there were, as you get with that forum, there weren't necessarily a lot of surprises. Most of the candidates turned out to be pretty much where we thought they were, I think, in terms of support for public education. It's hard to beat Warren or Sanders in this cycle, and Sanders just had an op-ed with USA Today this morning calling for an anti-stakes testing, which was the one piece that was kind of missing in his education platform. I think many of us were kind of surprisingly impressed by Klobuchar in Pittsburgh, who had been just kind of under the radar, but really was sharp and on top of things and really showed an understanding both of the issues and how things get done and taken care of in D.C. And from there, it was the other candidates were less impressive when it comes to public education.
Right. Were any did any of the candidates stick out as candidates that seem to still be enmeshed in what we commonly call corporate education reform?
I think Mayor Pete is, I still have real concerns about him. I'm not sure that he really gets it. He and Biden's another one in general, although his performance in Pittsburgh was a little different from his usual shtick. Hide behind distinctions like they'll be anti-for-profit charters. Well, you know, being against for-profit charters is really a nothing burger. There are hardly any actual for-profit charters out there. That's not how people in the charter business make their money. As you already mentioned, you make your money in the charter business by opening a non-profit charter and then attaching it to a whole bunch of for-profit companies that run it, that rent it to its building, that provide its services, and that's where money is made. And
yeah, I mean,
that's one of the things.
Yep.
That's one of the things that Sanders and Warren do seem to get, that you can't just talk about for-profit charters. You have to talk about for-profit businesses in education and in the charter industry.
Yeah, one of my great frustrations, and Diane Ravitch's great frustration, is hearing candidates say, I'm against for-profit charter schools. Now, the only state that still has for-profit charter schools, individual schools that are for-profit, is the state of Arizona. However, 20% of all kids nationally who go to a charter school are going to a charter school that is run or managed by a for-profit company. New York started to phase them out, but there are still charter schools in New York City that are run by for-profit management companies. And, you know, it gets very frustrating because we've had conversations with different candidates. We've made it clear. And yet, you know, they don't seem to get it. And you start to get the feeling that they want to hide behind something that sounds good, that gets them an applause line, but also has no meaning. Because the truth of the matter is as president, you know, they can't affect whether a state has a for-profit management company or doesn't have a for-profit management company. But now there was one candidate there too who I thought seemed to still be stuck in that old mindset of trying to reform education via privatization and business principles, and that was Michael Bennett. I mean, what did you think of him, Peter?
Michael Bennett doesn't get it and is not being particularly honest about his own history in Denver, where he very much was part of the corporate approach to reform, and not the lack of honesty about that. I find that's kind of off-putting to me. As somebody pointed out, you know, he tried to say that, well, you know, in Denver, we made it. We set things up so that a charter could only start with the approval of a local board. What he didn't mention was that they also set things up so that there was a state board that could overrule that local board if they wanted to. So he still seems to be pretty attached to the idea that business and corporate approaches to education are the answer. I was unimpressed.
I was really shocked when he said that as one of the solutions to is to just increase the time that kids go to school. In fact, what he said was, you know, there should be not only a longer school year, but if he had his way, they would go to school 6 days a week.
which is probably not much of a solution. But I don't know who you imagine is out there thinking, oh well, I want to vote for the 6 day a week school guy. That's what I want.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what untapped batch of voters you're getting at with that particular pitch, but
well, it was interesting.
Yeah, that was.
Yeah, and it was interesting because if you looked at the audience, what, you know, were predominantly members of the audience were predominantly teachers and parents.
Yeah.
And they were all kind of scratching their heads saying, you know, but it's that same kind of testocracy, the idea that, you know, if we just do it harder and faster and more, we're suddenly going to make this huge difference in the lives of kids, forgetting the fact that children need to play. They need to engage in sports. They need to have a social life. They need to spend time with their parents and not be sitting in a classroom learning to hate school at a very early age. And I mean, I think before we come go ahead, Peter.
Also the idea, and I hear this periodically from several of the candidates, the idea that the purpose of public education is to get people ready for a job. And that really education is all just about preparing better meat widgets so that corporations will have a better hiring pool to dip into. And kind of overlooking the fact that you're preparing human beings to have a life.
Yeah, I think as I listened to him, I heard threads of that, too, when he was talking about students in their junior and senior year of high school only going to school, I think he said, either 1 or 2 days a week, and the rest of the time being out in the world of work. And I'm kind of scratching my head going, don't we have child labor laws here? I mean, why would we want to take this really, really precious time when we have kids where we can teach them about democracy and teach them how to engage in critical thinking and instead, you know, push them out into the world to work doing, you know, who knows what during the day. And it was deeply disturbing. I was concerned, too, with Mayor Pete when he started bringing up something about the value-added measurements of, you know, evaluating teachers by test scores. Can you talk to the listeners a little bit about that? Because there are still some traces of that around.
Well, he tapped into a whole batch of that. The idea of a value-added measure, which came to us from a guy who studied agriculture, who figured that if we could just it's so hard to explain value-added measures because it makes so little sense. In business and manufacturing, it does make sense. You take a batch of sheet metal, and the sheet metal maybe was worth 10 cents, and you machine it and you turn it into a toaster, and now as a toaster it's worth $5. So you've added that value to the piece of metal. So it kind of adopts that manufacturing model for students. When we say, well, first we have to figure out what the student would have done in some hypothetical imaginary parallel universe. How much would they have learned? And then we look at this universe and we check their test score and we say, okay, well, here's Chris's test score in this universe. We're going to compare this to the imaginary score that we made up for Chris in the parallel universe. And if Chris did better in this universe, then we're going to credit that for the teacher and say the teacher added that much value to Chris. And we throw a whole bunch of fancy math at it, so it must be real. And that's somehow value-added measurement of teacher performance and school performance.
Yeah, and it's used very often in some states to determine which schools get to stay open, both public schools and charter schools. So we're going to take a short break. And when we get back, we're going to have another public school advocate join the conversation, and that's Susan Spicka, who's done some great work in Pennsylvania into trying to enact some reform to their charter school laws. This is Carol Burris. We're talking at a school, and we invite you to please call in at 212-209-2877. And ask your questions and share your thoughts.
You gotta hear something that's really hot. With the one you love, you're making romance. All day long you've been wanting to dance. Feeling the music from head to toe. Round and round and round you go. Hail, hail, rock and roll. Deliver me from the days of old.
Don't tell me to stop. Tell the rain not to drop. Tell me everything I'm not. Don't tell me to stop. Hi, this is Liz Wright. You're listening to WBAI in New York.
I was sitting there listening to him give his State of the State address, and my jaw dropped.
I thought it was wrong for a number of people to blindside me the day of the vote.
We have a schizophrenic healthcare philosophy.
This is Ben Max from Gotham Gazette.
And I'm Jarrett Murphy from City Limits. If you want to understand more about the challenges facing New York City and hear from people running for office or working on solutions, tune in to Max and Murphy. We'll talk to electeds and candidates, experts and advocates, and then open up the phone lines to hear from you. That's Max and Murphy, Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m., right here on WBAI 99.5 FM.
Hi, this is Carol Burris with a terrible cold, so please excuse my voice. And we are back at Talking Out of School, Talk Out of School on WBAI-FM. Joining me now is Susan Spica, who is the Executive Director of Education Voters PA, who's going to talk to us a little bit about what the unrestricted growth of charter schools in the state of Pennsylvania has meant for its public schools. Hi, Susan, are you there?
I am. Thanks, Carol, and thanks for inviting me to join you today.
Thank you for being on, Susan. I'm wondering if you could begin by telling us a little bit about your organization, Education Voters PA.
Sure. Education Voters of Pennsylvania was founded back in 2008 to promote a pro-public education agenda with the public in the hopes that we would be able to ensure that our state legislature and other elected officials would support a pro-public education agenda when they were, you know, passing laws and thinking about funding schools. And so we are a statewide organization. We have supporters in all 67 counties of Pennsylvania. And we have a lot of fierce advocates who just believe that, you know, public education is a public good and that we really need to support and defend quality education for all students in every school district. And in Pennsylvania, we face, as Peter alluded to, we face a lot of school funding problems in addition to the whole privatization issue. So our families have a lot at stake in ensuring that we hold lawmakers accountable for supporting our public schools.
Now, I know one of the places that you've been, or one of the areas, rather, that you've been pushing for reform is cyber charters. And we don't have, luckily, cyber charters in New York State, though I'm sure they would love to get part of the market since there's a big profit motive there. Could you talk a little bit about cyber charters in Pennsylvania, the kinds of funds that it's draining from public schools and also other issues around cyber charters?
Absolutely. And so I would say New Yorkers should thank their legislature for not allowing, you know, statewide, state-authorized cyber charter schools to get into New York. In Pennsylvania, we have 15 cyber charter schools. They are authorized by the Pennsylvania Department of Education. And any student in any school district in Pennsylvania has the right to withdraw from their local public school and attend any one of these 15 cyber charter schools. The tuition for cyber charter schools is exactly the same as the tuition for brick-and-mortar charter schools in Pennsylvania. And I think that pretty clear that when there is a company that is educating kids who are sitting at home on their computers, they don't have the physical facilities, they don't have the staff, they don't have the overhead costs that brick-and-mortar schools have. So we know that cyber charter schools are just, they're reaping a profit. They're just raking in money. And we've reached the point in Pennsylvania where about 35,000 students attend these cyber charter schools. And it costs taxpayers now over $500 million, like $500 million a year is getting drained out of our local public schools and going into these cyber charter schools. So it has an immense impact on school district budgets in every single school district in Pennsylvania.
Well, I mean, I'm just scratching my head as I listen to that. So the kid sitting home on his computer, logging in for a couple of hours a day, maybe a little bit more, but there's no heat that has to be provided, no water, no transportation, and yet they're getting this pretty much the same amount of funding they would get if they were attending either a brick-and-mortar public school or a brick-and-mortar charter school. I mean, is that so? How does the legislature justify that?
I think our charter school law was written 20 years ago, and when they introduced cyber charter schools a few years after that, they didn't change the funding formula to take into account that, you know, cyber charter schools would have fewer expenses than brick-and-mortar charter schools. And to be frank, I don't think that the legislature ever envisioned the just massive growth of these cyber charter schools and the amount of money that would flow into them and the number of students that would flow into them. And I will say, students flow in and out of these schools. So, you know, a student might enroll in a cyber charter school in the fall thinking it looks like a good thing, and then a few months into it, realize that's a bad decision and go back to their public school. Or, you know, another thing we see is students who are older enroll in cyber charter schools and it doesn't work out. And then they just, they disappear. They don't graduate. We don't know what happens to them. So, you know, I think when lawmakers wrote the cyber charter law, they really had no idea the monster that they were creating in the state. And right now, the cyber charter lobby is just really, really strong. And so any time that there is an effort to rein in these costs or to bring some sanity into this funding system, the cyber charters just, they flex their muscles. And we have not been able to get anything across the finish line, although I do think that is beginning to change because it is just, the financial impact is so incredibly huge. And, you know, school districts are raising property taxes to pay these cyber charter bills, and people are starting to wake up to that. And I think that that awakening is influencing the way that lawmakers are thinking about cyber charter funding.
You know, as a former high school principal, one of the most important functions that we had in the school was making sure the kids were okay. Right, that they were emotionally okay, that they were coming to school well fed, properly dressed, that there was somebody at home when they were going home. I don't know. I think you did some work and a study that talked about how kids sometimes leave public schools and go to cyber charters when schools express concerns. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Right. So we don't have any hard data on this issue. But I spend a lot of time traveling around the state and talk to a lot of superintendents, you know, and especially superintendents of very small school districts who know all of the children in their districts. And I've heard over and over and over again these heartbreaking stories of children who have attendance issues. So they are starting to get into like really serious truancy problems, and then their families, rather than, you know, kind of deal with the accountability for making sure that their kids are going to be attending school, they will withdraw their child from the school district and put that child into a cyber charter school. We also have heard like truly awful stories of school districts that suspect that there is some type of abuse or neglect in a home, and they report it to, you know, children and youth, and families are notified of that. And then, you know, the next day they come into the school district and they withdraw their child and put their child in a cyber charter school, which then isolates that child, removes that child from the watchful eye of mandated reporters who see the child every day. And that's perfectly legal and perfectly fine. And I think the problem in Pennsylvania is that there is no data collection about any of this. So what we have are anecdotes from superintendent after superintendent after superintendent, but we don't have any data. So I am really hoping that our state legislature will start looking at the child welfare issue of cyber charter schools and say, look, you know, we need to at least take the first step of collecting data. So how many absences has a student had in the past 180 days before, you know, that needs to be reported. And if there are any open child welfare issues with a child who's transferred to a cyber charter school, that also needs to be reported so that we can look at this data and get a handle on whether these are anecdotes or whether this is a systemic problem.
Yeah, I mean, it sure seems as though it would be a very, very serious problem. You know, I can think back on some of the students who, if there was an availability of a cyber charter when I was a principal, they would have taken it, and I know that it would not have been in their best interests. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, there was a study that was done about how kids actually do academically when they go mm-hmm. to cyber charter schools in Pennsylvania. Can you talk a little about that?
Right. So at Stanford University, the Credo group did a study in 2019 of cyber charter school performance, and they created a virtual match so that there would be a student in a cyber charter, and they would compare that student's academic performance to a student who was that person's match, same type of test scores, same type of demographics as someone in the sending school district that the cyber charter student left. And it was astounding when we saw the results. So students in Pennsylvania who transferred to a cyber charter school lost 106 days of learning in language arts in a single year, and they lost 118 days in math in a single year compared to their school district counterparts. Our school district year consists of 180 days. So, you know, students left their traditional public school, went to a cyber charter school, and basically made no progress at all. It was like they never even went to school. And so I think that this just speaks to this issue of, like, why is this? Like, is it the delivery system, like, that kids have a hard time learning online? Is it because students who, you know, have a lot of issues, like truancy issues, are going to cyber charter schools and they're not logging on and they're not even trying? Like, you know, we don't even we can't begin to understand why this academic performance is so abysmal until we start to think about, like, who is it that's going to the cyber charters and why are they going there? Because we also know there are a lot of kids who go to cyber charters because they might be homeschooled and their mom would find a cyber charter school to be a good support for her so that she's not having to create all the lessons by herself. So those are really high achieving students. We know athletes go to a cyber charter school. They're very high achieving students. There are some students who want to be able to, they're gifted, and so they want to go to a cyber charter school so they can accelerate and graduate early. So we know that there are some students who are doing really well in cyber charter schools, but overall this academic performance is just, there is like something really bad happening in these schools. And in Pennsylvania, cyber charter schools are allowed to determine how they count attendance by themselves on their own, however they want. So some might say you just log in the morning and that counts for attendance for the whole day. Some might say you have to have like synchronous instruction and actually meet face-to-face with some online instructor for a certain number of hours a day. Some say if you get all your assignments in by the end of the week, then you're considered attending for the whole week. And so there's just, you know, we don't even know if students are even going to these schools and even like logging on or attending, because there's no oversight over that. Yet we're spending $500 million to send kids to these schools where like they're falling behind.
Unbelievable. Well, we're going to open up the phone lines now for anyone who has a question for Susan or Peter or a comment on this important topic. And if you have one and you're not already waiting to speak, please call in with your question at 212-209-2877. Okay. This is Carol Burris, Talk Out of School. Who is this, please?
Yes, my name's Karen. I'm calling from Texas, and I do have connections in Pennsylvania. Actually, my family is originally from the coal mining area of Pennsylvania, where my grandmother was a teacher and my sister is retired from teaching in Erie. And I wanted to share, I followed the cyber charter issues in Pennsylvania and was stunned at how little oversight there was. Additionally, when the K-12, the major charter school, tried to start in Texas, I worked with the state PTA and others to restrict enrollment to at least starting in third grade, because some of the cyber charters wanted to take these babies in kindergarten. And additionally, there is a very high churn rate, as was pointed out by Susan. And in fact, one curious thing in terms of how the companies want to make money is that there are management fees connected with K-12, which is a real cash cow. The first charter school in Pennsylvania said after a few years, we can manage on our own. So what did K-12 do? They started Agora Cyber Charter. And the head of that program, because it was going to generate funds, and the head of that program was accused of fraud.
Right.
And there were significant problems, but none of the cyber charters in Pennsylvania, as far as I know, have ever passed the state.
Now, would you share with our listeners a couple times, you said K-12. So what is
K-12? Is the largest company, and it was started about 20 years ago, and one of the co-founders was Bill Bennett, the former Secretary of Education. And Michael Milken, the junk bond king, was also involved in the financing of this.
Oh.
And Pennsylvania was one of the first states where they saw the weakness, I believe, of the charter laws there and the opportunity to make money.
Well, thank you very much. We do have another caller, but thank you for sharing with us your experiences in both Pennsylvania and Texas. Hi, this is Carol Burris. You're talking out of school. And who is this, please?
Hi. I'd just like to keep that anonymous if it's okay. But I have an idea. I was just wondering what other countries because I know ours doesn't, clearly, teaches children at, like, the beginning of their schooling and on throughout their schooling as a mandatory part of the curriculum, law and how to read legalese and how to write legalese. Because when you move into a new town, if you don't know the laws there, you kind of become a criminal because you kind of wind up breaking some law inevitably. And this would make for better law-abiding citizens, and it would also make it so that more people would be encouraged to get into positions of office, because if you feel more comfortable writing laws because you know how to read and write legalese.
Right. Yeah, you know, I'm going to thank you very much for your comment, but we really want to try to stay on topic, so we're going to move to the next caller. Thank you, though. Hi, this is Carol Burris talking out of school. Who am I speaking with, please? Hello, are you there? Okay. All right, so we don't have anybody else who's called in. So, you know, Peter, I'm wondering if maybe you could join the conversation with Susan at this point and talk a little bit about your experience with cyber charters when you were a teacher in Pennsylvania.
Sure. Cyber charters are big in rural areas. They cost us a ton of money, and particularly in a smaller district like ours, there is no, pretty much all the stranded costs remain with us. In other words, when 50 students leave the school district to go to cyber charter, the reduction of cost for the school district is zero. None of our costs are reduced, but yet we lose hundreds of thousands of dollars. In the classroom, I certainly had students who benefited from cyber charters, particularly a couple of students who had very specialized needs that were better met in a home setting. But what I saw over and over again was the churn that you've heard talked about. A student would leave because he or his family was going to teach the school district a lesson and walk away from truancy problems or discipline problems. So they would leave, go the cyber charter route, and in 6 months to a year, they'd be back again, having basically gotten nothing out of their time away.
Now, Susan, I'm curious, because I know you were on a school board for a while in Pennsylvania, and if you have kids that are leaving, they're not really successful learning, and then they come back to the district, what kind of an impact does that have on the district and on the test scores in the district, especially considering that district performance is also measured by test scores?
Right. So it's hard for the district. It's hard for the teachers who have to work. Who have to work to, catch these students up. But the person that's really the hardest for is the student who has to come back and is maybe a year behind his peers, you know, maybe has to repeat seventh grade. This is a system that is set up for the cyber charter schools to make money. It is not a system that is set up to meet the needs of students. And I think it's really sad. And I think a lot of families, they make promises to families, come here and we will do this personalized, wonderful education for your child. And then they go into the cyber charter school and they realize that they're getting recorded videos that the kid has to watch all day. It's not that interesting. It doesn't, the student isn't actually learning. And then they've been sold a bill of goods of something that wasn't real. And then they go back and then it's just terrible for everyone except the cyber charter school that got to keep all the tuition for that student for that year. So in Pennsylvania, there's zero accountability for any of this. It doesn't matter how poor the performance of the cyber charters is. They can continue to enroll as many students as they can enroll through their, flashy advertising. And, in my town, I got a notice in the mail, a flashy, really pretty flyer saying that they were holding at a local hotel, a reception for families that might want to take their kids out of the school district and go into a cyber charter school. So I thought, we raised property taxes last year, and our property taxes are going to fund some, snacks or meals at the local hotel so that a cyber charter school can recruit kids away from our district.
It's just...
Yeah, that's... It's,
yeah, go ahead,
appalling.
It's worth mentioning that part of the cyber charter environment in Pennsylvania is lots and lots of marketing. You'll hear ads on the radio. You'll see bulletin boards. You'll see billboards out on the highway. You'll see lots and lots of glossy, shiny marketing, and every bit of it is paid for with Pennsylvania tax dollars.
Yeah, and that whole problem of advertising and pulling kids away. It's just not a matter of cyber charters. It's brick and mortar charter schools too. I mean, mm-hmm. I've seen buses here in New York City where you'll see advertisements for different charter chains on the side of the bus. Now, that's a lot of money, and that tax dollars are part of it. There was a little charter school I took a look at outside of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And it was a building, and this particular building that a real estate developer had bought. It was a former school, and there were just charter schools and private schools just churning through this building. They were not particularly successful. One would fail, the next one would come in. And this was all about this guy who owned this building making a lot of money. And when one of the new ones came in, there was a flyer And it was an anonymous flyer. Nobody could ever pin it on anyone that was put out talking about how horrible the public schools were in the area, which is not the case, and trying to entice people to come to the charter schools. And behind all of it really was money and people mm-hmm. making money. And you know, I think that as we talk about this and we talk about the cap in New York State, I'm hoping that what we'll do is we'll take a look at our neighbors in Pennsylvania. And for one thing, we'll certainly hopefully never do, and that is get into this cyber charter mess. We're one of the few states, by the way, that doesn't have cyber charters, and they're a problem everywhere they are. And then the other thing too is to make sure that we keep the cap, so we can limit the growth. And Susan and Peter, I mean, let me know if I'm wrong, but couldn't a district offer an online program for a student who needed it if they wanted to?
Yep.
Many districts in Pennsylvania have. Go ahead, Susan.
Yep. Well, our school district did that, and I think a lot of school districts do that because it costs, you know. You might be paying $15,000 for a regular education student and $27,000 for a special education student to go to a cyber charter, commercial cyber charter. And then in your own district, you can educate that student for $4,000 or $5,000. And so in our school district, we started one 4 years ago, and we have had immense success in having students stay in our in-house cyber charter school rather than going to the commercial cyber charters, especially students with disabilities, because they have an IEP manager in the district and they come into our schools to receive their services. And I think families are much, much happier with our program than they are with the outside program. Tricky for little districts like the one that Peter came from because you have to start up your own cyber program.
Thank you, Susan. Yeah, we're going to have to go. And I so appreciate both Susan Spicker and Peter Green being with us today on this very important topic. Hey, if you like the show, Talk Out of School, don't forget to sign up online as the BAI buddy for Talk Out of School. And thanks for listening in. Next week, Lainey will be back as host right here on WBAI-FM at 10 a.m. on Wednesdays, where we talk out of school. Thank you.
The guy behind you won't leave you alone. Ring, ring, goes the bell.
WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Talk out of school. And you will not hear this type of discussion anywhere else on the radio. You won't. That's Talk Out of School Wednesdays at 10 a.m. Make sure you visit our website, WBAI.org, and consider becoming a sustaining member in support of Talk Out of School.
Up to the corner and round the bend. Ride to the juke, John, you go in. Coin right into the slot. You gotta hear something that's really hot. With the one you love, you're making romance. All day long you've been wanting to dance. Feeling the music from head to toe. Round and round and round you go.
Hi, this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth.
Hi, this is Joe Strummer, and you're listening to WBAI, and it's all mixed up, and it's mixed in, too.
Okay.
A lot of folks like to bash the mainstream media. Those same voices rarely offer an alternative. Lucky for you, you've found the alternative already. You're tuned to it right now. Hi, my name is Reggie Johnson, and I'm the host of From the Soundboard. WBAI is a listener-supported commercial-free radio station that loves to challenge the norms and defy them. But in order to keep providing you with groundbreaking conversations and unique arts content you rely on, we need your help. Donate by visiting Give to, that's the number 2, WBAI.org, or pledge right from your smartphone by